Finally tonight, a cautionary tale for Christmas. It comes from Seattle librarian David Wright.
This is The Boy Who Laughed at Santa Claus by Ogden Nash. In Baltimore, there lived a boy. He wasn't anybody's joy. Although his name was Jabez Dawes, his character was full of flaws. In school, he never led the classes. He hid old ladies' reading glasses. His mouth was open while he chewed and elbows to the table glued. He stole the milk of hungry kittens and walked through doors marked no admittance. He said he acted thus because there wasn't any Santa Claus. Another trick that tickled Jabez was crying boo at little babies. He brushed his teeth, they said in town, sideways instead of up and down. Yet people pardoned every sin and viewed his antics with a grin, till they were told by Jabez Dawes, there isn't any Santa Claus. Deploring how he did behave, his parents quickly sought their grave. They hurried through the portals pearly, and Jabez left the funeral early. Like whooping cough, from child to child he sped to spread the rumor wild, sure as my name is Jabez Dawes, there isn't any Santa Claus. Slunk like a weasel or a marten through nursery and kindergarten, whispering low to every tot, there isn't any, no, there's not. No beard, no pipe, no scarlet clothes, no twinkling eyes, no cherry nose, no sleigh, and furthermore, by Jiminy, nobody coming down the chimney. The children wept all Christmas Eve, and Jabez chortled up his sleeve. No infant dared to hang up his stocking for fear of Jabez' ribald mocking. He sprawled on his untidy bed, fresh malice dancing in his head, when presently, with scalp a-tingling, Jabez heard a distant jingling. He heard a crunch of sleigh and hoof crisply alighting on the roof. What good to rise and bar the door? A shower of soot was on the floor. Jabez beheld, oh, awe of awes, the fireplace full of Santa Claus. Then Jabez fell upon his knees with cries of don't and pretty please. He howled, I don't know where you read it. I swear some other fellow said it. Jabez, replied the angry saint, it isn't I. It's you that ain't. Although there is a Santa Claus, there isn't any Jabez Dawes. Said Jabez then with impudent vim, oh, yes, there is, and I am him. Your language don't scare me, it doesn't. And suddenly he found he wasn't. From grinning feet to unkempt locks, Jabez became a jack-in-the-box, an ugly toy in Santa's sack, mounting the flue on Santa's back. The neighbors heard his mournful squeal. They searched for him, but not with zeal. No trace was found of Jabez Dawes, which led to thunderous applause, and people drank a loving cup and went and hung their stockings up. All you who sneer at Santa Claus, beware the fate of Jabez Dawes, the saucy boy who told the saint off. The child who got him licked his paint off.
That was The Boy Who Laughed at Santa Claus by Ogden Nash. It's a classic, copyright 1942. And it was read for us by Seattle librarian David Wright. To hear David read another story, it's called Noel, go to our website, npr.org. And for Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays from all of us. Every once in a while, being stranded at the airport can have an upside. Take the time commentator Teresa Amon got stuck in a terminal, and she heard a story from a man she'll never forget.
You know I've got the Alzheimer's, don't you? The man's words took me completely by surprise, and for a second, I thought I'd misunderstood. He'd been sitting next to me in the crowded airport and had been cheerfully chatting away for at least 10 minutes. Maybe a decade older than my 57 years, he'd been friendly and charming and totally articulate. I, on the other hand, had been my usual distracted self. Clicking off my cell, I finally gave him my full, undivided attention. A little begrudgingly, I'm embarrassed to admit now. I'm sorry, sir, but did you just tell me you had Alzheimer's? Yes, he said. As a matter of fact, I did. He never told me his name, and I guess he won't remember mine. But he did tell me his story, how it was just about a year ago when his longtime boss first suspected something was wrong and suggested he see a specialist. Single and living alone, he'd made the difficult decision to go ahead and leave his home and friends to be near his daughter, so when, as he put it, this stuff got worse, she would be nearby to take care of him. It had been hard at the beginning, leaving all his friends behind, but he had made new ones and even had a lady friend now, and life was good again. He was excited, too, because this was his first trip back home. He said he wanted to visit those friends he missed so much while he still remembered them. The airline man, he assured me, would tell him when to board. Because, he added softly, he just couldn't read anymore. Written words were a mystery now, impossible to decipher. It was, he declared in an exasperated voice, the darndest disease. He paused then, shaking his head and staring blankly at the wall, seeing things I think only he could see. Friends and memories and a life that he'd clearly loved. A smile hovered on his lips as though his thoughts brought him joy, and I was glad for that. But as he looked up and his eyes met mine, just for a fleeting moment, there was such bewildered sorrow in them, it took my breath away. Just as quickly as it was there, it was gone, and he straightened his shoulders ever so slightly, and with all the brave dignity anyone could ever wish for, he smiled kindly and asked me ever so gently, "Now, did I tell you I have the Alzheimer's?"
That's commentator Teresa Amen. She lives in Dallas, Texas.
And now we take you to New Orleans and another group of people who've been waiting on a rebuilding project. Hurricane Katrina closed most of the city's schools for an entire year. Many buildings were destroyed or had to be abandoned, including Andrew Wilson Elementary School in the area known as Broadmoor. But early next year, a beautiful new school will open its doors to this recovering neighborhood. NPR's Larry Abramson got a sneak peek with the teachers and has this postcard from New Orleans.
3 years ago, neighborhood organizer Latoya Cantrell showed me around the old Wilson Elementary. Katrina had flooded its lower level, then the school sat abandoned for months and was crumbling. Truth is, this once grand edifice was neglected before the storm, and it was not known for high achievement. Cantrell vowed to rebuild this school and its reputation.
Regardless of who the babies are in the classroom, quality learning will happen.
Y'all move up so I don't have to shout. Okay, come. No, y'all.
Nearly
right
3 years later, the dream has been fulfilled. Wilson Elementary has been rebuilt, complete with a huge addition. A couple of weeks ago, Principal Sheila Thomas welcomed teachers to their new home.
I wanted to have wine and cheese, but I knew just as sure as I brought wine into the building that we'd lose our charter next week. So
2 years ago, Thomas came out of retirement to head Wilson Elementary at its temporary home a few miles away. In the meantime, local activists waged the fight of their lives. They convinced state, local, and federal authorities to spend millions rehabbing Wilson. They turned a stately but tired building into a dream of a school, light-filled, high-tech, souped up with all sorts of ecological features. For teachers like Gwendolyn Bellazon, it's a miracle.
It's overwhelming. It's very overwhelming to see what they could take from a very antiquated building and bring it up to speed with the green plan.
So do you know where your room's going to be?
Oh, yeah. Believe it or not, my original room is going to be my room here again.
To LaToya, it wouldn't have happened.
Teachers and staff toast LaToya Cantrell, the woman who spearheaded this effort. They raise their plastic glasses of sparkling cider and dig into a green and gold cake that salutes their recent designation as a high-achieving school. Then teachers scurry off to check out their new classrooms, where the paint still sparkles and the furniture is free of little fingerprints for now. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Now, while Disney's marketing campaign for the film and the merchandise is massive, with millions of dollars behind it, one of our producers, Selena Simmons-Duffin, came across an entirely different way to market gifts, gifts you might normally call, well, junk.
On a frosty afternoon in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, writer and editor Joshua Glenn unpacks his research subjects.
Here is a coconut carved into the shape of a pirate with a little earring and an eye patch. This is just an ugly, tacky bear with a tie-dyed vest and a little peace glasses. And he's making a peace symbol and he's sitting in a lotus position. Here is a salt shaker, which is in the shape of a bag that holds a bowling ball.
As junky as they may seem, Glenn calls these things significant objects. They're part of a project he's doing with New York Times Magazine columnist Rob Walker. So here's how it works. They buy a knickknack at a thrift store and match it with an author, from big names like William Gibson to up-and-comers. The writer invents a story about the object, which then gets posted for sale on eBay. Glenn and Walker are trying to see whether adding a story raises the object's price. Take this little plastic Russian doll with a big cloth mustache that's mounted on a little piece of wood.
It's just an ugly, homey little thing that I bought. But Doug Dorst wrote a very funny story claiming this was a woodcutter named Vralkomir, who during a particularly bad blizzard when everybody in his village in Russia were freezing to death, danced so hard on a little piece of wood that it burst into flame.
So do these stories really pay off?
According to my facts here, we sold $128.74 worth of insignificant doodads for $3,612.51. So that was a 2,706% increase.
That Russian doll he bought for $3 at a thrift store, it sold for $193. And the added value is not just about the price.
As the kind of curator of the project, I thought that I would be immune to the stories, but I had a really hard time letting go of some of the objects. So there is really something hardwired in us to want things to be meaningful.
The Significant Objects Project is also about finding magic in unexpected things, like this Conair portable hair dryer from the 1970s. Writer Douglas Wolk concocted a story about an experimental musician who used it as an instrument in his final performance.
I think we should plug it in and play it.
Music? Maybe not. But it's more than just hot air. For NPR News, I'm Selena Simmons-Duffin.
Listen to these five voices. They are all from the same actor.
The truth does not make it easier to understand, you know.
Rosie, I was thinking we might get another rooster for you.
We're talking about my baby daughter.
We must be careful in the pageant that we neither hide Donald Millen or put him forward.
I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
The many, many voices of Meryl Streep. Bob, what an amazing actress.
Is that? I've never heard those voices placed together like that before, but oh my God. You know, you always say she's inhabiting a character. She really does, doesn't she?
That is, of course, our film critic, Bob Mondello. He's been joining us each weekend this month to talk about some of the distinctive features from film this past decade. And Bob, you're here today to help us talk about some of the decade's standout movie accents. And, of course, we've got to start with Meryl Streep.
Yeah, and those last two were actually from this decade. The earlier ones were not. But the last two were Doubt, when she took on a sort of a Bronx accent, and Julia, which is, I mean, that's more an impersonation than an accent,
yeah,
but
right.
Boy, did she nail it. I think of Meryl Streep as representing the internationalizing of American acting, right? That she's one of many actors who go out and they do accents from all over the place. And you get used to the idea that an American actor can play anything because essentially in our movies, American actors do. Think about, for instance, Morgan Freeman. This is an example from right now, who is playing Nelson Mandela in a movie that opened just last weekend, Invictus.
Reconciliation starts here. Forgiveness starts here, too. Forgiveness liberates the soul. It removes fear. That is why it is such a powerful weapon.
Now, that sounds pretty persuasive, does it not?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, why not get a South African actor for that? Well, because Morgan Freeman is well-known and Clint Eastwood likes to work with him. So without him, the movie probably wouldn't get played.
And Clint Eastwood directed that movie.
Right. It's funny because lately, if a foreign star gets big enough, then the foreign star can internationalize too. I mean, if you think back about it, Sophia Loren always played Italian, right? Mm-hmm. So in past decades, foreign stars stayed wherever they were, kind of, internationally. Whereas Antonio Banderas, or listen to me trying to do an accent as I'm saying his name, or Penelope Cruz are sort of all-purpose Mediterranean or all-purpose Latina. And, you know, they end up playing all over the place because now they can do that too because they've become big enough.
And it seems to me that just about every British or Australian actor these days can really nail an American accent. People like Nicole Kidman or Christian Bale who I had no idea was even British or Kate Winslet.
Well, that's true. And actually, when you hear them do their own accents, when you actually hear them outside of the context of the movie,
it's weird.
It really is. I've got one that I want you to hear. This is James McAvoy, who was in this big action picture where he sounded totally American. It was called Wanted.
You know when you have a dream and you're half awake, but it's still in the fringe of your brain, and then you open your eyes and you're so damn glad it was a dream? This was nothing like that.
Now, I would maintain that that's a pretty good American accent, right? I mean, I didn't really question it.
I wouldn't think it was an accent.
Now, listen to James McAvoy being interviewed about that same film by Jay Leno.
It's based on, like, a graphic novel written by a guy called Mark Miller, who, funnily enough, is from Glasgow, like me in Scotland, but it's set in Chicago.
No, seriously.
That is unbelievable.
Isn't that amazing? That's what he sounds like in real life.
It must be
very strange to be the accent guy, the sort of vocal coach. There's got to be somebody behind the camera saying something like, you have to flatten the A, right? You can't say can't. That isn't how an American says it. He says can't.
And listening to that Morgan Freeman clip reminded me of Leonardo DiCaprio in Blood Diamond. He plays a South African.
That diamond is my ticket out of this godforsaken continent.
Yeah, and he was pretty persuasive, wasn't he?
He was, absolutely.
I think most of the time, I think actors get the accents basically right. I mean, enough so that you accept them.
Well, were there any accents from the past decade, you know, that you watched in the theater and they just stood out as being totally and completely atrocious? You were just appalled watching them? Sort of like Kevin Costner on Robin Hood?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was special, wasn't it? Well, in the last decade, I guess I'm more struck by the people who avoid using accents. There are some stars get so big that they feel like they kind of can't do it. You never hear Tom Cruise attempt an accent, for instance. He certainly avoided taking on a German accent in Valkyrie when he played a Nazi out to assassinate Adolf Hitler.
We'll have no choice but to seize power in Berlin to prevent the SS takeover. We have to kill Hitler.
I didn't see this movie.
Well, that's what the movie was like. I mean, you know, and on some level, that's why it kind of didn't work. When George Clooney was shooting The Perfect Storm back at the beginning of the decade, the producers wanted him to do a Boston accent, and he said no. He said that he explained his decision to the New York Times. I'm going to quote here. "I'm a fairly famous guy," he said. "And when you suddenly hear me with a weird accent, it'll take away from everything else. I don't want the audience spending the first 15 minutes of this movie like the RCA Victor dog trying to figure out what I'm doing." And I think that makes excellent sense, don't you?
That's our film critic, Bob Mondello. He reviews films for this program. And this month, he's been looking at some of the notable movie moments from the past decade. Bob, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
And we want to hear from you. What were your favorite accents from the past 10 years? Join the conversation at our website. That's npr.org.
And in media circles, it is a truism that at some point, somewhere, golf star Tiger Woods will have to come out of seclusion and sit down for a televised interview. In network parlance, such interviews are gets, and they aren't scheduled, they're booked. NPR's David Folkenflik takes us to the front lines of the television booking wars.
Specialized news producers called bookers fly across the country, even across the world, seeking a way to make connections to the people their networks want to land. Jim Bell is executive producer of NBC's Today Show.
Booking is the game. That is the game.
It's more than just bragging rights. Exclusive interviews help generate publicity for big money-making shows like Today and ABC's Good Morning America and The Oprah Winfrey Show, as well as for their celebrity hosts. Jessica Stewart used to be a booker for NBC and for Oprah Winfrey, and she says they're all in the hunt.
They're figuring out who might be some intern's cousin's neighbor who caddies at the golf resort that Tiger Woods played at 3 years ago.
Since the earliest days of the Tiger Woods scandal, ABC News has had a Swedish-speaking producer camped out in Sweden to talk to relatives of his wife, Elin Nordgren. Stewart says she learned her business wasn't for the faint-hearted early on, back when she worked for Today.
During the Monica Lewinsky scandal, my competition had gotten the first interview with her attorney, Ginsburg, and I physically threw myself in front of his car while it was moving to try to stop it to get an interview. I was 21 and really hungry. No one told me to do it. I just wanted that get.
In fact, several television news executives I talked to said that the last big get that compares to Tiger Woods was Lewinsky herself, a decade ago, right after the U.S. Senate acquitted President Bill Clinton.
Monica, did you feel that you were in competition with Hillary Clinton?
Sometimes. Sure.
Barbara Walters of ABC News booked that blockbuster interview back in 1999. Another big get occurred 2 years ago, when the British princes William and Harry sat down with Matt Lauer of NBC's Today Show. Networks say they don't pay for the interviews. Ordinary folks, like survivors of a natural disaster, might get flown to Manhattan and put up in fancy hotels and kept away from lurking competitors. But that Barbara Walters interview? ABC gave Lewinsky the rights to sell the tapes of the interview abroad, netting her hundreds of thousands of dollars. And NBC paid $2.5 million to the Prince's Foundation, named for their mother, the late Princess Diana, officially for the rights to broadcast a benefit concert in the United States. Jim Bell is executive producer of The Today Show.
There's no question there are things that have gone on, I guess, with interviews that make people a little queasy. I feel like, for the most part, though, we meet our standard. We're going to ask anything. We're going to be able to do, you know, no one comes in here and gets a cakewalk. And I think if the viewers feel comfortable with it, we feel comfortable with it, that's fine.
He says that Woods has strong enough incentive at some point to do it without anyone having to strike special deals.
To move on, to get his story out, assuming he has one. I mean, I think there's a lot in it for him. He has to get past this, and part of that is answering some questions that people have.
The Woods story first broke in the National Enquirer just after Thanksgiving, and it's been playing out ever since. Lori Blackford is a former senior producer for Good Morning America and briefly for the CBS Early Show. She respects the Today Show, but says she's surprised it broadcast interviews with two women who said they had had extramarital affairs with Woods.
Wanting that big interview, you really have to weigh. Is it worth doing talking to these women and possibly losing Tiger because of that?
Today's Jim Bell says that consideration never came up. He points to Today's top-rated status for 14 straight years in the morning show wars.
When you can simply say to people, more people are going to watch you on our show, that's a very powerful card that wins a lot. And in many cases, people will come to us, you know, and sometimes before we even have reached out to them.
The confessional interview has become an almost unavoidable ritual for disgraced figures to emerge once again in public. Former TV booker Jessica Stewart.
Who is their audience? Who do they want to mea culpa to? You know, do they want to mea culpa to women? Then they go to Oprah, Tiger Woods. I mean, who does he want to apologize to?
If it's the hardcore sports fan, expect to see Woods on ABC and its sister station, ESPN. A lot can be told by who books the get. David Falkenflik, NPR News, New York.